WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the American automobile industry. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, writing from the assembly lines, Ben Hamper, once a third-generation auto factory worker, chronicled his experiences in his 1991 book, Rivethead. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine also worked on an automobile assembly line. He'll read from his 1992 collection, What Work Is. Also a new poem from poet and Fresh Air classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, and John Powers reviews the new film, Emma. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Bob Dole visits the Eisenhower Memorial Library in Abilene, Kansas today. Speculation is growing about whom he'll select as his running mate. Dole now says he's made his final decision. An announcement is expected by tomorrow, NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Dole's hometown of Russell, Kansas will be swarming with media seeking the answer to the only real question surrounding the Republican convention. Who will get the nod for the number two spot on the ticket? The Dole campaign has worked hard to generate as much suspense as possible, floating names of past and present GOP governors and senators, only to say a few days later that they're no longer in the top tier of candidates. At the moment, former New York Congressman and Bush cabinet member Jack Kemp is the focus of attention. The conservative supply-sider would make an able spokesman for the tax cut package announced by Dole this week. But the two men have had an uneasy relationship, most recently when Kemp endorsed Steve Forbes for president. Other contenders include Florida Senator Connie Mack, Michigan Governor John Engler, and former South Carolina Governor Carol Campbell. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The government reports inflation at the producer level was flat in July. The producer price index was unchanged last month. The news is likely to reassure those who were worried about growing inflation. Richard Berner is an economist with Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh. He says the so-called core rate of inflation was actually up a little. The core rate of inflation excludes the volatile food and energy sectors.
A rise in food prices was expected and a big drop in energy prices. And we saw the latter but not the former. Other than that, only a tenth of a percent rise in the index apart from food and energy, and that was even better than most people had expected.
Wholesale prices have increased 1.9% so far this year. Russian President Boris Yeltsin was sworn in today for his second term as president. It was his first public appearance since his re-election last month. As the BBC's Diane Goodman reports, there's been increasing speculation about the health of the Russian leader.
Today's inauguration ceremony was about as short as it was possible to get and still remain decent. As soon as the Kremlin bells had finished striking at 12 o'clock, the orchestra began playing and Boris Yeltsin walked onto the stage. He looked pale and impassive and held his arms stiffly at his sides. Mr. Yeltsin read a presidential oath, promising earnestly to serve the people of Russia and to protect all human rights. Some Russians found that pledge difficult to swallow because even as he spoke, the bloodshed in Chechnya was continuing.
Diane Goodman reporting. The U.S. State Department warns U.S. travelers in the area of Cali, Colombia. The agency says guerrillas have targeted foreigners and their businesses. It says there are increased chances of kidnappings. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 4 points at 5,709. This is NPR. Residents of Nagasaki, Japan, commemorated the 51st anniversary of its atomic bombing today, which occurred at the end of World War II. About 25,000 people gathered in Peace Park for a memorial ceremony. It began at 11:02 in the morning local time. That's the moment when the bomb was dropped, August 9, 1945. Bells tolled in churches and temples throughout the city. Few traces of the bombing can be seen today in Nagasaki. Everything was rebuilt. In Hiroshima, city authorities left the half-destroyed atomic dome standing as a reminder of the bombing. Parents of French victims in last month's TWA air crash have filed suit in France. They want to force U.S. investigators to reveal more information about their findings. The Paris-bound plane exploded soon after its takeoff from New York. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Parents of three teenage girls who died in the explosion filed the suit with a public prosecutor in Paris. Asked that France, in addition to the United States, investigate the cause of the crash. The parents also wrote a letter to Justice Minister Jacques Toubon seeking his support. The letter says the contradictory information from U.S. investigators about the disaster had caused the parents immense pain. Lawyers argued that France has jurisdiction over any crime against an aircraft, even if it is not French, provided a French national is on board. The Justice Ministry refused to comment on the suit. Everyone on the flight died, including 42 French people. French relatives of the victims will receive immediate compensation in France if the United States declares the explosion was caused by a terrorist attack. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
TWA crash investigators, meanwhile, are looking at the wreckage of the Boeing 747, particularly the plane's midsection. They're concentrating on debris closest to Kennedy Airport. No traces of a possible bomb have been found, although that is one of the leading theories behind the crash. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. For more than 10 years, Ben Hamper spent his days on the assembly line at the General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan. He assumed he'd be there for life, just as his father and grandfather had been. But Hamper discovered he had another talent. After work, he began jotting down observations about life on the line. And when he sent a record review to the local alternative paper, they printed it. Turns out the editor was Michael Moore, who went on to direct the GM-bashing film Roger and Me. Moore felt that the review was so wonderfully sick that he offered Hamper his own weekly column. Impressions of a Rivethead, named for one of Hamper's jobs on the line, became one of the most popular columns in the Flint Voice. Hamper's tales from the assembly line were collected in the 1991 book Rivethead. Since that time, Hamper made an appearance on Michael Moore's satirical and short-lived TV show, TV Nation, and he had a small part, along with Michael Moore, in the movie Canadian Bacon. I spoke with Hamper when Rivethead first came out. Here he is, reading from the first chapter.
I was 7 years old the first time I ever set foot inside an automobile factory. The occasion was family night at the old Fisher Body plant in Flint, where my father worked a second shift. General Motors provided this yearly intrusion as an opportunity for the kin of the workforce to funnel in and view their fathers, husbands, uncles, and granddads as they toiled away on the assembly line. If nothing else, this annual peep show lent a whole world of credence to our father's daily grumble. The assembly line did indeed stink. The noise was very close to intolerable. The heat was one complete bastard. Little wonder the old man's socks always smelled like liverwurst bleached for a week in the desert sun. For my mother, it was at least one night out of the year when she could verify the old man's whereabouts. One night a year when she could be reasonably assured that my father wasn't lurching over a pool table at the patio lounge or pickling his gizzard at any one of the thousand beer joints out on Dort Highway. My father loved his drink. He wasn't nearly as fond of labor.
You write that before visiting the automobile plant, you thought that your father built cars all by himself. When you first saw an assembly line, what was your reaction?
Actually, I was quite terrified because I'd never seen anything like this. It was so huge and enormous and noisy and filthy that I actually felt, sorry for my father. You know, I just assumed that he went to some glitzy little garage and, you know, built the cars out of kits or something, you know.
So what you saw then was a real glimpse into...
My future.
Into your future, your father's present and your future.
Mm-hmm.
What did GM do to make families, or to try to make families, feel part of the company?
Not much, I guess, you know. Once a year, I think they let the families come through. And, of course, they were all under the umbrella of the wonderful GM benefits package. But... Otherwise, I don't really know what else they did.
Was GM able to create some kind of identity or even a sense of loyalty for the people that worked there?
In Flint, Michigan, certainly, yes. It was a family tradition, you know. I'm a fourth-generation shop rat, or was. And it was just handed down from, you know, generation to generation. Your father would get you an application once you got out of high school, and you'd sign up, and it was just like going in the Army, you know. Well, except you went in for 30 years.
It was the only game in town, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. In Flint, if you don't work for GM, I mean, you pump gas, or you flip burgers, or you just sit by railroad tracks and, you know, watch the sun come up and go down.
When you first started working for General Motors, you were assigned to the cab shop, which was known as the jungle. Can you describe what it was like, your first day on the job?
It was very terrifying. They led us up to the jungle, which is on the second floor, where they do all the welding on the cab bodies. And there's sparks shooting everywhere in every direction. People are MIG welding and spot welding and brazing. Just lots of heat, noise, fire, and the overall claustrophobia of all these wires hanging down and huge cables looping everywhere. It was just, a horrific scene. And I remember that first day I hired in, I said, well, what I'll do is I'll make it to the end of this shift, and then it's bye-bye. I'm going to look for something else. Maybe I can still become a disc jockey or something.
You describe the noise, and you say it's like it was like some hideous, unrelenting tape loop of trains having sex. I almost know what you're talking about when you write that.
I like that line. If you really think about it, that's what it was like. Imagine trains having sex, you know, if you can possibly imagine that. Going on for like 8 hours a day, and that's about what it was like.
I noticed, too, on your first day on the job that the foreman or the overseer called you boys. Was that what bosses called workers, boys?
Some did. This guy happened to. I didn't take any personal affront to the thing. Sometimes they called you. Well, I can't say it here. Is this a family radio show? I mean, everything from... A lot of times they referred to us as bodies. I didn't like that. Like some department would be short a few workers on a Friday because guys didn't come into work on Friday or something, and the foreman would shout out, hey, we need a couple bodies over in, the axle line. I thought, ooh, bodies.
You didn't think of yourself as a body.
Well, And when I think of a body, I think of a cadaver, you know. Of course, a lot of us, you know, felt like cadavers in there sometimes.
Ben Hamper is my guest, and he worked on the GM assembly line and has written a book about those years, and they were from 1977 to 1988. The book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. Reading about your book, it sort of reminded me a little bit of what you also seem to describe as your Catholic education.
Yeah, there's similarities.
Can you tell us more about that, those similarities?
Jeez. Well, outside of the fact that, you know, I never swallowed a lot of the stuff that the nuns crammed down my throat, and I never swallowed a lot of the hokey bunkum that a lot of the supervisors like to cram down our throat. That was probably the biggest, you know, parallel.
So you never went for it?
No, no. You know, it was actually demeaning at times. I write about our implant mascot. They actually dreamt up a mascot for us, which was this, like, 5'6" gigantic kitty cat named Howie Make'em. And it was a guy in a cat suit with a large, huge, enormous cat head with whiskers and a cape with a Q on it that stood for quality. And he'd romp around, come down the aisles, just like, you know, it was a football game back in junior high, you know. And you know, that kind of stuff was just preposterous and demeaning after a while. We ran with the joke at first, but, you know, when we thought about it after a while, we said, oh, my God, this is what they think of us, you know, that we're just these zombie nitwits, you know, that can only relate to, you know, cartoon character figures or something.
After working in the cab shop, you went to the rivet line, and you said that it kind of got into your blood. You got a certain satisfaction out of doing the rivets. Tell us what you did.
Well, I had a couple different jobs down there, but they both revolved around riveting pieces of equipment onto the frame. But I just had this sick fascination with rivets and riveting. I enjoyed it. I really did. I enjoyed the feel of the rivet gun. It was powerful and strong, and I just became so proficient with it that I could twirl it and make it do everything I wanted, and it was just like a third arm to me. And I really prided myself on being probably the best riveter in the world, and hence, one day I realized I was the quintessential shop rat and the greatest riveter in the world, and I so deemed myself Rivethead. This all happened in the span of about 30 seconds, and there were no news bulletins about the occasion at all.
And hence the name of your book, of course.
Yes.
You also write about watching the clock. I mean, the almost the torture of watching the clock during the day. How did it haunt you, just the passage of time?
Oh, it would just crawl because, you know, they'd have clocks stationed everywhere. I think it was just sort of a sadistic gesture on GM's part to put all these clocks everywhere. And if you got in the habit of doing your job and then sitting down waiting for the next job to come and staring at that clock, you would swear that thing was not moving, not budging, and time would go so slow. I've often said, and I'd like to repeat here, that my main gripe was not with GM, as with their clocks, as with the clock. That was our enemy. It wasn't General Motors. You know, General Motors, you know, they were culprits in a lot of stupid buffoonery, but those clocks were our main enemies, and making them move was our goal each day through any kind of diversion we could think up.
Would you have been better off without a clock?
Certainly, I think so. I mean, most guys wore watches anyway, but at least with the watch you could sort of control it. I can remember, I will not look at my watch, you know, for what I think will be an hour. And then I would think an hour would pass, and I'd look at my watch, and like 9 minutes passed, and I would go, oh, my God.
You're listening to Ben Hamper. His 1991 book, Rivethead, was about his years working on the assembly line at the General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ben Hamper is my guest. His book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. When did you begin to write for the Flint Voice?
I believe somewhere around 1980, 1981.
And it was Michael Moore that...
Michael Moore. He was the editor of the paper, and we had met, and we became friendly. At first, I wasn't writing at all about the shop, but he kept edging me in that direction, always telling me that he thought that that would be a very, very good thing in this town in Flint, Michigan. People would be interested in, and I resisted. But finally, I gave in. I started writing the column called Impressions of a Rivet Head, biweekly, and it proved to be probably the most popular thing in the paper and generated more mail and everything else than anything else. So we stuck with it, you know. Mama didn't raise no, dunce, you know. I just, grabbed the golden udders and kept them milking, you know.
You had an ongoing or an open-ended invitation to Roger Smith, who was head of General Motors, to go bowling with you. Were you truly serious?
Oh, yeah. I really was. To me, and I still don't understand GM completely, they have no sense of humor or anything. They would pipe up all the time about how management and the workers had to come closer together to, to smash down these walls of animosity. And, we're all one team and this and that. And so here I am extending in my column quite often the invitation for Roger Smith and me to go bowling some Friday night, like, say, a guy would at a gas station with his boss, just to prove. And this would have gotten just incredible PR, I can imagine all the networks there to see, And I was offering, no one else was offering to do this, so I took it on myself. The Rivet Head, bowling with Roger Smith, and it'd be a very friendly thing, and, no wagering. We would just, he'd drink his scotch, and I'd drink my pitcher of beer, and, it didn't matter who would win, It wasn't a challenge, like, hey, we can beat you, We represent the workers, and we represent, management. But they never followed through, but then again, They're always known for shooting themselves in the foot.
What do you think Roger Smith and others' idea then of developing this sense of purpose and comradeship? How did they do it? Was it just these once a year kind of family invitations to the factory? Or did they have other things that they did too?
I'm not aware of any other things they did, no. A story I do have show you sort of where Roger was at with... his relationship to his, millions of underlings. One day, he was scheduled to come to our plant, the Flint Truck and Bus Assembly Plant, to view these new military vehicles. We had just finished the first batch of them, and he was going to show them off to some admirals or some generals or something. And everyone was very excited by the fact that he was going to show up that day, and we thought, he'll probably be walking down the aisle with bodyguards and waving, and we were all quite excited. We were going to see the head honcho, the chairman of the board, B-O-R-E-D. And sure enough, like 3 hours into the shift, the foreman came around informing us that we were all being sent home. And I asked the foreman why. And he says, well, no particular reason. I said, well, is there a shortage of parts? Is there a breakdown? No, no. We're just sending you home today. And then it dawned on me, finally, that they were sending us all home so Roger wouldn't be polluted with the sight of all of us shop rats, dirtying up the atmosphere. I really took umbrage, and I was really, really angry about the whole situation after that, and I wrote about it. Because, what was a factory without factory workers? How did trucks get assembled without assemblers? And what they were doing was kicking us out so when Roger came through the plant, it would all be sterile and quiet, Not a real factory.
Ben Hamper is my guest. His book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. It's about his years working on the assembly line at the General Motors Truck and Bus Plant in Flint, Michigan. You had a nervous breakdown. Is that right?
I wouldn't.
Would you call it that?
No.
What would you call it?
I had a series of very severe panic disorder episodes.
What do you think they were caused by?
To this day, I have no idea. You know, it came out of the clear blue, and I'm sure they were exacerbated by my... is that the right word? Oh,
I think
that's
so.
That's like a five-syllable word. Well, I think they were exacerbated by my working at GM because it lends itself to a very claustrophobic environment. And like I said earlier, the shot began to wear on my nerves. People seemed stacked, you know, too close together. There were no windows. It was so noisy, you know, and I just got this feeling of suffocation after a while. And it, one night it all broke loose on me. It was just an average shift, and I was, in fact, I was on break, and I was reading the sports page, and everything just went totally crazy. Mm. My heart went beating crazy, my arms tingled, my legs tingled, my vision went all to hell, and I immediately left the plant, and a few days later saw a doctor when this started to reoccur, and was soon put in a mental health clinic where you saw me and Roger and me, and was diagnosed as having panic disorder.
When was the last time you had one?
About 4 minutes ago. No. When they told me I couldn't have another cigarette. No, I don't know. You know, I still have anxiety attacks and stuff. A full-blown panic attack, it's been a while, a couple months, you know. But, you know, I don't blame this. I don't put this at the foot of GM because I would also experience these things like in shopping centers, mm-hmm. at red lights, you know, standing in line to buy razor blades. So.
You left GM, but I wonder how much you've been able to get it out of your system.
It's been difficult because I had planned to work there. Of course, I'd be laid off anyway, as it turns out. But, you know, I had planned I had a good thing going. You know, I was making good money, and I'd just gotten remarried, so I obviously needed money. And, you know, it was entwined with the thing I was starting to love, my hobby, this writing thing. So I had so much vested in returning to GM. But I was just unable to do it. And finally, the doctor that I was seeing just disallowed it, said, look, you've had it. I'm not going to send you back there anymore. And it was just sort of a farewell to arms and legs and toes and, you know, all the things that get chopped off in rivet guns.
How would you improve things there? What would you do?
I don't know. I think I would have a system where the jobs got rotated so people weren't stuck on the same job for years and years and years, you know, and just, you know, rotted away on these things. And a guy couldn't just keep one job that was really good while his neighbor worked his butt off three times as hard and got paid the same amount of money. I would rotate jobs like every 6 months, you know. And I'd also smash the walls down and put in windows.
There are no windows?
No, there are no windows, you know. And you never tell if it was day or night or raining or sunny, you know. And I remember a couple times they had tornadoes go by and we didn't even know about it. We'd get out of the shop and, you know, it's so noisy in there, you know. We'd turn on the radio driving home and, yes, the tornado that went right through near the GM truck and bus plant 4 hours ago. We're going, what? Tornado? So that was the noise up on the roof, huh?
Well, I thank you very much, Ben Hamper, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
I've had fun. It's been a privilege.
I spoke with Ben Hamper in 1991 after the publication of his book Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. We checked in with Ben Hamper yesterday to find out how he was doing. He told us he still has panic attacks from time to time. He does have a contract for a second book, and he's been talking to Michael Moore about future television projects. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what work is. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine reads from his 1992 collection and talks about his years on the assembly lines in Detroit. We'll hear a new poem from commentator Lloyd Schwartz, and film critic John Powers reviews Emma. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we're noting the 100th anniversary of the first mass-produced automobile with two writers who began writing when they were working on automobile assembly lines. Poet Philip Levine spent years in Detroit working at an auto factory. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1991.
A review in the New York Times described my guest, poet Philip Levine, as a large, ironic Whitman of the industrial heartland, loyal to his roots in Detroit, determined to remember the exhausted and enraged worker, the unlucky immigrant, the man who gasps for breath and asks, "Am I going to make it?" Philip Levine worked in the factories of Detroit as a young man. Now work means writing poems, but the sweat and fire of factory work continued to be the subject of some of his most compelling poems. I asked Levine why work has become such an important theme in his poems.
I suppose because most of my poetry originates in memory. Coleridge said that really the only thing the imagination has to work on is remembered experience. And I find this is very true in my own case. Also, my working days went from age 14, that kind of work, heavy manual labor, from age 14 to about 29. And it seems to me that I was more sensitive to the world around me. I was a learner. I was somebody with his eyes open, constantly looking for teachers. And I think as a youngster growing up in these circumstances, I was just more open to sensation, more open it's an odd word, but almost an exotic world. It was the work of automobile assembly factories and that. It's a very exotic place, or it was when I was very young. There was fire, there was noise, it was like bedlam. Sometimes, I remember going into a foundry once to get a job, and I was about 17, they wouldn't hire me. I was too young. And thinking, really, I'm in hell. Yeah, this is like hell. You know, it was so hot, and it was this liquid metal, and I was terrified. I was glad they wouldn't hire me.
I want you to read the title poem from your new collection, What Work Is. And is there a story you'd like us to hear about the poem before we hear the poem itself?
Yeah, there is. There's a curious story. I never worked at Ford Highland Park, which I mentioned in the poem, but I went there once for a job during a period in the early 50s in Detroit when there was a kind of a slight recession, so a lot of people got laid off, although Detroit was a booming town back then. And I waited in line, and it was raining, and it was a long wait. You know, the newspaper would advertise, you know, assemblers. That's the lowest job you can get. And they would put hours down, like 8 to 5. But you knew you had to be there early if you were going to get a job. And so you got there maybe 7:30. Well, they didn't open the employment office till, say, 9. So you stood there for an hour and a half before anything even opened. And there were 50 people ahead of you. But that was in a way to, you know, they wanted to test you. You know, how much crap could you take? I mean, were you willing to wait in line that long? If you weren't, they didn't want you. And so as I waited, I grew angrier and angrier at myself for being this humble character. And finally, maybe about 10:30 or so, I got up to the head of the line. And there was a guy sitting down. I was standing. We each went to a different desk. We stood, they sat. And he said, "What kind of job would you like?" And I don't know where this impulse came from, but I said, "I want your job."
Oh, gee.
And he said, "Okay, take off." And that was it. But I was sort of happy that there was this thing in me that was still there that, you know, said, you know, I don't want you and you don't want me. And so I suppose that I never forgot that moment of standing there all that time and then being, you know, a smart mouth.
Did you have the money to afford to mouth off like that and lose the pay for the day?
No. No, I didn't. I remember I went to Chevrolet Gear and Axle, which was an awful place, later that day, and got a job there, which was just as bad. You know, it was just as bad a place. I was married at the time. I had to make a living. I had responsibilities. So I really couldn't afford to be who I wanted to be. Yeah. Let me read the poem. What Work Is. We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac, so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young, or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No, just because you don't know what work is.
We're listening to Terry Gross's 1991 interview with poet Philip Levine. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1991 interview with poet Philip Levine.
When did you start writing about your experiences in factories? Were you still in factories when you were writing poems?
I was unable to write any poetry about my working life while that was my working life. I tried a few times, and the poems were hysterical. I think they were just, you know, I couldn't control them. My anger was so overwhelming that I couldn't cope with it. Just as I couldn't write about my boyhood very effectively until I was 40. It was still too powerful for me. But I'm patient, so I hung in there, and that's probably my chief virtue as a writer, is my patience. So I waited, and I kept trying to write about factory work, but I kept throwing the poems away. And the first poem I ever published about working in a factory, I was, I think, 31 or 2. But I don't like the poem anymore.
Can you give me a sense of what was going wrong in the factory poems when you were still there? Is there anything?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I can. The language was overblown. I wanted to use the word eternity, and I wanted to use a kind of Latin diction, to almost a Miltonic diction, and a great chorus, build up a great chorus of sound, and to dramatize the horror show of some of the places I'd worked. And I didn't have any. There was no tenderness in it for the people that I worked with. There was no, that was part of the reward that I got for those years, was the people I was meeting, even though you didn't talk to them that much because the places were often so loud. But you'd meet them afterwards, or you'd make friends with them and spend time with them. And they weren't getting in the poems at all. The poems were my poor soul being hammered out of shape by General Motors. And they were a bit self-indulgent. Yeah.
A lot of times there's usually like two main reasons why a 14-year-old would work in a factory. One is because he or she or the family needs money. But the other is to be taught the meaning of work by well-meaning parents. So why did you start working in a factory so young?
Well, the jobs were there. It was World War II, and anybody in Detroit could get a job. And I wanted the money. I did it for the money, honey. I remember two young anarchists came to see me once when I was living in San Francisco, and they were enormously disappointed that I hadn't gone into factory work as a young guy to form cadres of the working class.
Yes.
I said to him, I tell you the truth, I went to make a living. And, I was discovering the beauty of women, for example. Actually, they were probably girls. I was more interested in women, though they weren't interested in me, naturally. I was 14. I was very short, too. And I thought in order to romance women, the way fellows were doing it in the films I was seeing, I had to have some money in my pocket. I had to have a suit to wear. I had to, if I possible, I could get a car somewhere. And it was hard to carry on a romance on the on a Detroit bus or a streetcar. And so these were things that were driving me. I mean, just what drives, you know, 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds all over America today, I suppose. And so I took these jobs and saved my money and got my suits and wasted my money.
I want to get back to something you said early in the interview.
Sure.
You said that, then this is when you were, you know, waiting online for factory jobs and knowing that you might get turned down. You said you couldn't afford to be who you wanted to be. And I think within that sentence is a pretty interesting class analysis about identity. You know what I mean? That it takes a certain amount of money in a way to live, not only to live the life you want, but to be who you want to be.
That's right. That's right. I mean, for example, I was politically very conscious. I was aware of exploitation. I remember my brother and I, at about age 10, swearing we would never exploit other people. We would never live off the labor of other people, you know, in a way in which they were abused and we were given an advantage on their hard work. And I remember when I worked at for a General Motors factory once, you had to take these IQ tests before you started working. And they said, you know, we'd like to put you into our management program. You've done very well on this IQ test. I lied and said I'd never gone to college or they'd never hire you. And they said, gee, these scores are wonderful. And I said, no. And they said, we would send you to Flint, Michigan. You go to a school there. You know, we have a slavery school there. You know, you'll be taught really how to torture people effectively and subtly. And we'll pay it twice as much, and when you're done, we'll give you a suit and a tie. Wouldn't you like to do that? I said, no, I just like to be a slave myself. I mean, I didn't like being a slave, but I had taken an oath that I wasn't going to exploit people. And my brother was watching me. I couldn't break it. He's a very stubborn guy. And so it was a determination we made. It would be nice to be able to afford it. Of course, then what do you have to do? You have to change the world so that lots of people can take that oath and live it, right? And how did I choose to change the world so that was more possible? I wrote poetry. And I actually thought, and this will strike you, Terry, as idiotic.
I actually thought that
writing poetry would be a means of changing the world because what I was reading was changing me so radically. Nothing in my life had as much power over me as what I read, both poetry and fiction. And when I began, too, I wanted to be a novelist as well as a poet. Then, of course, when I published my first book in an edition of 220, I said to myself, gee whiz, this is a big country for 220 books.
But you feel that in some ways poetry is obsolete for a lot of people because they have movies and TV and songs to tell their stories.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. By this time, I didn't care, because by this time, I had fallen in love with the poem, and I loved writing it, and I didn't care. I mean, it was what I had to do, and whether it changes people or whether it doesn't, it's what I have to do.
Philip Levine, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's nice. It's a pleasure.
Philip Levine spoke with Terry Gross in 1991. He read from his collection What Work Is. A paperback version of his 1995 book, The Simple Truth, will come out next month. That book won him the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. Fresh Air classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is also a poet. His collection of poems is called Goodnight, Gracie. Lately, he's written some new poems about his mother and her precarious health.
The dream during my mother's recuperation. At 89, my mother is in the hospital, mysteriously losing blood, when suddenly her stomach hemorrhages. She's rushed into surgery, but is not expected to survive. 2 years earlier, the hospital cardiologist prevented the operation that might have prevented this emergency. He thought her heart couldn't take it. After the operation, she remains in intensive care for 3 weeks, most of that time with a breathing tube down her throat so that she can't speak at all, though she can write short, very shaky notes. Take it out. Thirsty. Put my teeth in my mouth. I'll be here alone. Slowly, to everyone's astonishment, her strength begins to return. These are some of the things she said to me in the hospital and later in the convalescent home. Worried about me? It's a tough apple to chew on. I'm not doing anything, but I'm doing it the hard way. I might as well make a good job as none at all. I'm a human being. Worry is one of my stations. I'm a specimen of deliberation. I'll sleep my years away. I'll let things go the way they come. I feel lost. I'm heading for nowhere. I have to stop somewhere to see where I'm landing. Whatever is going on will be going on without me. It passes so fast. That's life. The winter sun is like a stepmother's love. I'm one day closer to the end. Nothing goes easy for me. I can't stuff myself like a turkey. Sometimes I wake up and I don't know where I am. Then my mind begins to unravel and I know where I am. Then there's some distraction and my thoughts go behind bars. I'm not very happy here. People are so snobby, some of them think themselves more than they are. However, I don't give a hoot. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm on this side of the wall. I'm on the other side of the wall. I don't know what they want from me. I know the feeling. It's staring me in the face. I just can't throw it away. Did I just say something stupid? The Chirinskys have been bubbling up in my mind. It's good to talk to you. You're giving me a line to live on. I'm okay. I'm not a world's winner, but I'm doing okay. Well, your mother came back. I'm whole again. I'm glad I'm not a question mark. I'm a human being. A lot of it was you pulling me back into a land of freedom, goodness, and love. During the later stages of her recuperation, I dream we're about to embark on a long ocean voyage. The moment we board the ship, we're ordered to put on life jackets, or we will not be permitted to continue. Only my mother doesn't have one. I look everywhere. I comb every inch of the ship. I can't find one for her. I have so much to look forward to. I'm renewing my life all over again. What you hear from me, this is me. Let's live and tell these little stories.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and the Frederick S. Troy Professor of English and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air. The latest Jane Austen novel to be adapted to the screen is Emma. It features the much-publicized Gwyneth Paltrow in the title role. Our film critic John Powers has this review.
Back in the late 60s, Hollywood was mad for D.H. Lawrence. The Fox, Women in Love, The Virgin and the Gypsy. These movies fit the temper of a rambunctious time. They were all about rebellion and sex. These days, we're always hearing about family values, and the movies have a crush on Jane Austen. Small wonder, her books are all about marriage. In Emma, Gwyneth Paltrow plays 21-year-old Emma Woodhouse, who swims among the provincial gentry of Highbury like a swan circling ducks. Delighted by her own brilliance, she's a vainglorious meddler who knows what's best for everyone. She spends much of the movie trying to marry off her lowborn protege, Harriet Smith, to the Reverend Elton, a clergyman so unctuously ambitious he could host infomercials on turning Christ into cash. Although the Reverend would never marry the penniless Harriet, Emma persists in trying to pair them up, while we wait for her to realize her folly. We're joined in this by her brother-in-law, Mr. Knightley, who views Emma with both admiration and disapproval, especially when he hears that she's urged Harriet to turn down the proposal of a local farmer.
She is the natural daughter of nobody knows whom. The advantage of the match was entirely on her side.
What? A farmer? Even with all his merit, a match for my dear friend? It would be a degradation for her to marry a person whom I could not admit as my own acquaintance.
A degradation? For illegitimacy and ignorance to marry to a respected, intelligent farmer?
She is a gentleman's daughter.
Whoever her parents, they made no plans to introduce her into good society. She was left with Mrs. Goddard for an indifferent education. Her friends evidently thought this was good enough for her, and it was. And she thought so too until you began to puff her up. Vanity working on a weak mind produces every kind of mischief.
You dismiss her beauty and good nature, yet I would be very much mistaken if your sex in general does not think those claims the highest a woman could possess.
Men of sense, whatever you may say, do not want silly wives.
Emma was written and directed by Douglas McGrath, who co-wrote Bullets Over Broadway. Being charitable, one can say that his movie has some of the breezy high spirits of a 40s Hollywood film. It races along at a breakneck clip and has a few amusing comic performances. In particular, Juliet Stevenson's pungent turn as a malevolent social climber with the face of a selfish pickle. But the movie lacks the depth of last year's adaptation of Persuasion, or even of Clueless, which transposed the story of Emma to 90s Beverly Hills. McGrath seems eager to please at any cost. His Harriet Smith isn't simply a limited woman, as in Austen. She's a giggling ninny played beyond the hilt by Muriel's Wedding star Toni Collette, whose sense of nuance can only be termed Australian. In the original novel, Mr. Knightley is a middle-aged man whose experience lets him give Emma the guidance she needs. Evidently, McGrath was worried that this age difference might put off modern viewers, for Mr. Knightley is played by the handsome young actor Jeremy Northam, who's busy looking dashing when he's not beetling his brow with moral rectitude. Emma is being hailed as the arrival of Gwyneth Paltrow, a radiant actress with a generous open face and an equally lovely comic manner. She seems at home with Austen's epigrammatic chatter. But Paltrow's aura is a bit too benevolent for the role. She lacks the ruthless brilliance that makes Emma Emma and not simply a suburban A student. Emma must be a woman so sharp and so bored that she begins to dehumanize other people by treating them as furniture to be arranged according to her own private whims. This comes through clearly in the film's strongest scene, when Emma makes scornful fun of the tiresome spinster Miss Bates. Miss Bates is crushed. You can almost see her soul crumple. And Emma, with some coaching from Mr. Knightley, has a sudden, painful perception of her own capacity for cruelty. It's a perception that redeems our affection for her. The great joke, of course, is that despite her glittering intelligence, in fact, because of it, Emma isn't wise. She gets everything wrong. She's so busy arranging other people's lives that she doesn't heed the promptings of her own heart. To earn the happy ending we want her to have, she must first learn that it's dangerous to be too brilliant. This is a valuable life lesson for everyone, not just Emma. I only wish that in making this uninspired movie, McGrath had taken it a little less to heart.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy Westman, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Lawrence Donahue Green. Alan Tu directed the show this week. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, protecting what's left of the grizzly population. We'll hear from Doug Peacock, a Vietnam vet who's waging his own war to protect the existing grizzly habitats. I'm Marty Moscoane. Join us for the next Fresh Air.